Lonis went. Vivian, well, tell us your story. You were 12 years old when the war started?
I was actually 8 when the war started and 12 when it finished.
What do you remember from being an 8, being an 8-year-old? I'm trying to think. 8-year-old is not, 8 years old is not very old.
It isn't, actually. I was interested in history from, fact, I suppose, the day I started school. I memorized presidents' names and cabinet members and baseball teams and everything. But, and so maybe it wasn't so much my age as it was the shock of sitting at the table with my folks and hearing President Roosevelt give this, that we had been attacked. And the fear, I think my brother was 2 years younger than me, and the fear that all eligible men were going to have to join the fight. And we were just sure my dad was going to have to go. And so that's why I remember. I remember our dad hugging us, or us hugging dad, and just hanging on. I mean, it was, so that's how I know that's what happened. I have that written in another book, too.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you remember life changing, or did it change? I'm sure it did, but how did it change after that? I mean, I assume you're going to school, you're 8 years old.
Well, you know, probably the first thing that I would remember was sugar rationing. And our car sat in the garage for probably almost 3 years on blocks, no tires, and, of course, no gas. We walked everywhere. I mean, a small town, too. There wasn't a lot of conveniences, but people didn't expect a lot of conveniences then. And so for us, that was probably the biggest change. The other thing was nobody had any money. I mean, not parents, not any kids. And the scrupulousness of how we saved our pennies to buy war bonds, those little $5, you'd get 5-cent stamps, put them in a book until you got enough, and then buy a bond. And by the time the war was over, if I remember right, I had 6 bonds that I had bought with nickels. And I cashed them when I went to the University of South Dakota in 1956.
That's something.
Yeah. They were,
was that common during the time?
Yes. I think all the kids that I knew, all of my friends, did the same thing. And it was the communities, everybody was behind us winning. You know, every place you went, they had the loose lip sync ships. We want you. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that you saw. There's another thing that I remember was that there was no scraps and no cans on the streets, because they brought a railroad car to town, and anybody that lost something and someone else found it, they threw it in this boxcar. And when the boxcar was full, the train came and got it and hauled it off, and they brought it empty and started over again. And I mean, and they did the same thing with rubber, by the way, but I didn't have much to do with rubber as much with the tin.
How big was Vivian at that, and the Vivian community, knowing that it's not only town, but it's, how big was it at the time?
I'm gonna guess about 160, mm-hmm. counting the outlying area.
Did you know, or did people know who had families that had people in the service and in the war?
Oh, yeah. Everybody cared about everybody else, and if you had people in the service, the respect, the appreciation, the probably, I don't remember that because I wasn't the parents,
mm-hmm.
But I do know that the people that had family in the service got together a lot, and I do know that. They played cards. And I'm sure they talked about the war, which, you know, kids are outside tearing around. But I think another thing that I can remember is how intense we were about conforming to when they said there's going to be a blackout. We and everybody, there was not a light in town or in the farm or anywhere. Everybody went to the dark. And I remember my mom cautioning us not to pull the curtain back, just that little teeny-weeny bit. And there was one candle in the center of the room as all the light we had. And she was very vehement about us getting bombed.
Mm-hmm.
What I think was the motive. But, I think the blackout. Oh, by the way, I was doing Vivian history. We had our centennial last year, and I found in the old newspapers that the Vivian Telephone Company billed the community $1.43 for a blackout notice.
Really?
Yes, and I thought that was really something else. I guess another thing I remember about the war was our Blue Star families. You knew who had kids in the war. And Vivian, as small as it was, actually had two Gold Star mothers' families. And so our town for its size, took a pretty decent hit. And our son is in the making a career of the United States Air Force. He's a lieutenant colonel right now. And he's been in Zagreb, Croatia. He's been in Baghdad. He's been in Kabul, Afghanistan. And we are unbelievably proud of what he does. And I think I maintain that patriotism and attitude about America that I probably started 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Now, during our screening today, you talked about later when you were old enough, you served and went back to Germany.
Right.
And tell us what you saw there when you got at, and what year was it when you were years when you were back there?
I went to Germany late fall of 1955, and I stayed all of 1956. And so I was there about 16 months. But it was still the recovery. We were still in the Lend-Lease, the Marshall Plan of rebuilding Germany and rebuilding the countries. I was in the Signal Corps, and they sent us all over there to help different groups. And so I saw hundreds of towns that probably were important because probably railroads or maybe a bridge, something that was
strategic importance
mm-hmm. to winning. And I could not believe the destruction. I mean, we saw churches that were just the spire, the part where the spire is held standing. The rest of the church is gone.
And then this is almost 10 years after the end of the war.
This is 10 years after war. Well, they were still, the streets were still full of rubble when I was there. I mean, they just couldn't, it was so huge, they just could not do that. We ended up in 1994 going back over there, and we went to some of the same places. In fact, we went to Berlin. When we'd been in Berlin back there in the 50s, the Reichstag was totally, practically demolished. And they had rebuilt that thing and made it the same authentic sculptures that was on the original. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I saw it, actually. That they had done that to that building. I mean, because it seems like centuries ago that was in style, that they did it.
When you were there 10 years after, what was the reaction to the German civilians to you as an American, as an American soldier?
As an American soldier, there was one thing we felt. Every day, no matter where you were, when they played retreat, you stopped and you saluted the nearest flag, the flag that you could see. And one of the things that will probably always be with me is the Germans, as we were standing there saluting our flag, looking down, looking away, in my opinion, partly having been vanquished, but secondly, wishing that they could salute. I think they would have rather been Americans. And so that's something that I'll never forget. And it may not, you know, that's just my opinion. I never really visited with someone about that. But,
In talking to people who were young and in service age during World War II, one theme keeps coming up again and again, and that was the sense of togetherness, pulling together, all united on one side. As a young person at that time, did you get a sense of that?
I think it was winning. By the time I went, you know, we were in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thought when I got out of high school was, I want to go to Korea and kill some gooks. This is enough of this. And because that's how I felt inside, I actually wanted to go to Korea, ended up in Germany, which is usually not military procedure, usually. Mm-hmm.
If you want to go, they'll be more than happy to accommodate you.
On the bus. Mm-hmm. But I thought probably if when you think about all for one, one for all, you know, I was in when the black population was beginning to really mingle with the white, and there had always been that, what would I call it, they kept us separate until about in the 50s. I think Eisenhower was president is when that changed, actually. They had separation before that, and so I served with kids from North Carolina, and we all were friends, played a lot of basketball, and all that kind of thing. So we pulled together because communism was coming on. It was the new hate in the world, and so we united.
You're the second gentleman I've talked to today from Vivian, and the other was Mr. Moore, and he was just that much older than you were, but I assume you two have known each other now for a long time.
Long time.
What do you think about him and guys like him?
I say thank you to everyone. It doesn't matter whether it's World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and now Iraq, the Desert Storm. If I see some men with their uniforms on, I'm congratulating and thanking them. So that's kind of how I still feel. And Dave and I have been such good friends forever. He was my banker, so I had to tiptoe by the window sometimes. but you know, another point about Dave. Back in 1994, when we had the 50th anniversary of D-Day, my wife and I started putting away money 4 years before, because we had already made up our mind we were going to Normandy, and we got there, and I did tell that earlier today. Would you want me to?
Sure, go right ahead.
When we reached St. Miraglis, where the paratrooper had hung from the church steeple, and the tour of the town, they took us to this church, and we went in. The church was 1,000 years old, and we saw this, and they have a stained glass window that is probably 40 feet high, and it's got a parachutist hanging in it. Then we went to Collierville, where the 166 acres of white crosses. And you can't keep a tear back there. And so I took the extra money just down the bluff to Omaha Beach. And I went down there, and my son and his wife and my wife were alone. And I probably stood there for a half an hour just looking out to sea, up and down the shoreline, trying to imagine what that could have been, the pain and the screaming and the bullets and the shells and the planes going over and the unbelievable sights and sounds of it. Would have happened that day and those 2 days. And I did tour all the beaches and saw the mulberries. And I had this unbelievable sense of pride that we were able to do that. And while we were there, we stayed in Bayeux, France, which had been the French capital after the Germans took Paris. And the people there, from the hotel people to the restaurants, the bars, on the street, loved us. They loved Americans. They never forgot as much France has, much to our dismay, I think, forgotten. But the people in Bayou and the surrounding, we went to Cannes. We went to several towns there just to see. But those people loved us. They threw fun. But I wanted to add one more story about Dave.
Mm-hmm.
That's at St. Miraglis. They have a museum built there, a World War II museum. It's built in the shape of a parachute, of course, because that's where most of the parachutists landed and died. But I was walking around looking at the exhibits, and a lady walked up, and she kind of put her arm around my shoulder, and she said, "We thank you." And she thought, of course, that I was a veteran. And I said, "No, I'm not. But I got a friend at home who is." And I had bought a book about this. And I said, "Would you sign this for me?" And she said, "You bet." I said, "To Dave Moore." And her name is on there. And so I gave that to Dave when I got back. And so that's how close friends we are, I guess. But I just want her to thank him indirectly.
So. Mr. Wendt, thank you for your service, number one. Thank you for sharing your stories, number two. We do appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
I appreciate that, too.